6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. With us in the studio today is the publisher, current publisher of the progressive magazine, Matt Rothschild. I thought we'd have a kind of freewheeling discussion, a sort of kind of end of the year wrap, but talk about some of the current hot topics in the news at the, whatever, the local, the state, the national, international level. We're going to invite you shortly to call in with topics, ideas you'd like to discuss, or with a question or comment for Matt today. So again, a freewheeling, what he and I occasionally do here. Matt, I know you've been following quite closely, as is your wont, this whole ongoing NSA imbroglio, the scandal that has become the NSA. Just the other day, it's been an interesting week, actually. There was a court ruling against the NSA and the Obama administration for all intents and purposes. And now the 300-page report of this review group on intelligence and communications technology. They made a bunch of recommendations. Again, recommendations very soft in that sense. To reform the NSA and to rein it in, if you will. So let's jump in there. Let's talk about your read on this, on that current situation.
Well, it was amazing. The judge's decision, one of the most amazing things about it was this judge was appointed by George W. Bush. I mean, he wasn't a card-carrying member of the ACLU like I am or some flaming lefty. He was a conservative and good conservatives used to do, he was standing up for our civil liberties and saying it was Orwellian what the administration was doing with the NSA and that it was likely to be unconstitutional, which is what Edward Snowden was saying from the very beginning. And this is a real vindication of Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald should get a Pulitzer Prize for this story. If he doesn't, there's something even more wrong with U.S. media than Bob McChesney and John Nichols have been saying all along. And Snowden is far from being a traitor, as the administration has been trying to make him out to be, threatening him with prosecution under the Espionage Act, like they do with other whistleblowers. He's a whistleblower. He's a patriot. And we would not be having these conversations today if it were not for Edward Snowden.
You know, just the looking at the news wires this morning, I came across this thing that was put out. You want to hear Orwellian? Here's Orwellian for you. The former CIA director, James Woolsey, right, on Tuesday said that for anyone thinking about giving Edward Snowden amnesty, he came up with harsh words for anyone thinking about giving Snowden amnesty and argued that the NSA leaker, right, should be hanged by the neck until dead. Now, here's the former CIA director talking about traitors and hanging people and so on.
I mean, other people have been calling for his assassination, people on Fox News, for instance, and some Democrats have been calling him a traitor, and of course the punishment for being a traitor is to be executed. Now, Woolsey, remember, was a member of the Project for New American Century, and he was one of the neocons who brought us into Iraq. So, right. If someone has to do some penance at some point, it's going to be James Woolsey.
And then, of course, Snowden said on Tuesday that he's willing to divulge information gathered by the NSA to Brazilian authorities in exchange for asylum. The Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff postponed a state visit to the U.S. in response to these new revelations about NSA spying on Brazilians.
I hope they give him amnesty. I mean, Snowden is a hero down there. Greenwald lives down there. And Dilma was, as she's referred to commonly, she was furious at the administration and refused to meet with Obama. And, he's not, I don't think, comfortable in Moscow for the rest of his life. He'd be better suited going down to Brazil.
Yeah, the let's go back to the findings. This 300-page report, the main points of this review group on intelligence and communications technology. So it was pretty interesting.
Well, some of it was far-reaching. I mean, they were saying that the NSA needs to get a court order. God forbid they follow the Constitution and get a court order as required by our Fourth Amendment. This is what the NSA has been violating consistently, and it's vacuuming up of our phone calls. And also, I know this report dealt with the phone calls, but also with the keystrokes on our computer or our smartphone and social messaging. You're supposed to get a court order if you're the government and you want to get information on an individual in the United States. And so it was refreshing to see that they were trying to follow the Constitution in this report. But again, it's advisory. Obama said that he agrees with some of it. He's going to review it on his vacation and then decide which ones he's going to keep and which ones he isn't. Is that really where we should rest our constitutional privileges in the hands of a president, or should Congress make sure that the NSA isn't violating the Constitution here as it has been consistently? But, you know, we've had a lot of Democrats, Dianne Feinstein, coming to the defense of the NSA. Everything they were doing practically she was defending. So I'm very suspicious that anything serious is going to come of this report or come out of Congress, actually.
And then, of course, the other part of this story this past week was that some of the big telecom computer online networks have come out critically against part of this report, of course, suggested that these private companies should take over, basically take over the surveillance.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't make me feel more comfortable either, that this information should lie in private hands. It said, well, why should Apple and Google and Yahoo hold this information either for so long or even for any time at all? I mean, that's where we've come in this technological age, that these big companies have all sorts of private information that people are stupid enough to cough up to them.
Yes, I guess we all are. They get us one way or another. You're listening to Matt Rothschild, our guest today on A Public Affair. Again, as I said at the top of the hour, this is a kind of open, freewheeling conversation. We can discuss what you wish. Nigel behind the glass there is already signaling that we do have a caller. So I guess we can go, you know, again, this is a kind of open discussion here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, going back to the beginning of this thing, our Congress, you know, how did they allow George Bush appointed John Poindexter III to be in charge of facial recognition after six counts of lying to Congress? I mean, forget the fact that, you know, Senior pardoned him for, you know, the Iran-Contra thing. But how does Congress allow a guy who lied to them six times and was convicted of it for all that time and trouble to become, I mean, basically, he started this whole thing. And under Bush, he was given six tetras of hard drive. The information awareness system, you look this up online, and down in the bottom corner, there's a little circle. There's all these different arrows going to different information things. There's circles here and there, but corporate memory is down in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, six tetras was more than 1.5 times all the existing hard drive at the time this happened in, like, 2003.
Okay, caller, let's...
He was the heart of this.
Thank you, caller. Let's, John Poindexter, one of these, what did I say, only the good die young?
Well, this is just one of the Iran-Contra characters, but I have to disagree with the caller, because this isn't all about John Poindexter. He wasn't the guy behind the whole thing. This would have happened whether John Poindexter was there or not. I mean, this comes straight out of the USA Patriot Act, Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, that allows the government to go grab any business record it wants. I mean, this was commonly referred to as the bookstore or library section, where they could ask the owner of the bookstore, you know, who bought which book, or ask the librarian who checked out which magazine. But it's much broader than that, and this has been the loophole that they've just driven this whole NSA truck through. But yeah, it's not Poindexter. It's fusion centers. It's Joint Terrorism Task Force. It's InfraGuard. It's what the NSA and the CIA were established to do, or have had a bad habit of doing. So it's way beyond that one person.
You know, of course, so many people back, it seems like ancient history, but back there was this presidential candidate that was running on a campaign of hope and change. And there were many people that thought that part of that change would be a dismantling or a major revision, at least, of the Patriot Act and these intrusions on basically on civil liberties domestically here in the States, and what has been the effect? The Obama's administration not only renewed the Patriot Act, but deepened so much of this.
Yeah, I mean, he said he was going to restore our civil liberties, and there's not a choice between security and liberty. And then ever since he got elected, he's been singing a different tune. I mean, he proves, you know, the old adage, where you stand is where you sit, and he's sitting in the Oval Office, and he's in the emperor's chair.
Any further thoughts, Matt, on this whole NSA thing at this moment?
Well, one thing that's really interesting to me and kind of makes me uncomfortable is I find myself agreeing with Rand Paul and James Sensenbrenner. I can't remember the last time I agreed with James Sensenbrenner. Rand Paul sometimes. But both Sensenbrenner and Rand Paul have been calling for the prosecution of James Clapper, who's head of national intelligence, because Clapper went before Congress and testified that the NSA was not scooping up mass communications from American citizens. And then later he was forced to apologize for it and said, and this was the biggest blooper of 2013, he said, it was the least untruthful thing I could say at the time. Well, there's a guy admitting that he lied to Congress. And so Sensenbrenner thinks he should be prosecuted for it. And actually, Rand Paul just yesterday said, I find that Clapper lying to Congress is probably more injurious to our intelligence capabilities than anything Snowden did.
We got our lines beginning to light up a little bit with questions, for topics for conversation, what have you, with our guest today, Matt Rothschild. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I thought it's pretty interesting that you brought up how that you find yourself agreeing with Rand Paul. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the prognosis of us getting rid of, you know, this whole Patriot Act and spying onto our citizens and constant violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. Is there any way that we can use this as an opportunity to find sort of a convergence of forces and actually make some kind of lasting change so that our constitutional rights could be more meaningful?
Well, I appreciate the call and the sentiment behind the call, because I do think this is an opportunity for people on the left to get together with some honest people on the libertarian right who really do believe in protecting our civil liberties and weren't under a rock when George W. Bush was crushing our civil liberties, but were opposing what Bush was doing too, and come to agreement on these sets of issues that we agree on, which is civil liberties and war and empire. And true libertarians like Ron Paul are against the U.S. empire. And so to the extent we can make common cause with them while keeping our principles on things like corporate power, because libertarians are crazy, they don't believe corporations really exist or are a threat for that matter. But I do think there are times when it is okay to make common cause with people on the right if they are honorable and principled on key issues like civil liberties and empire.
Well, you know, these what's commonly referred to as, in contrast to the neocons, these what are often referred to as paleocons, who have this principled stand. It's a very long strand deep in our political culture of what it used to be referred to as isolationist strand. No foreign entanglements, right? And along with that, defense of the, you know, certainly the Bill of Rights. So you're right on there, and there's lots of discussion now about having these kinds of alliances and who can you block with around those key issues. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
I had a question for both of you. This is just speculation, of course, but it's my theory that Obama couldn't have been. Of course, he got elected with corporate money. But he was, of course, also, you know, a protege of the Daily Machine in Chicago, and I guess he pretty much espoused the Chicago School of Economics theories even before he became president. And I don't think he could have been elected if he hadn't made deals with Wall Street and the kinds of people he appointed as his advisors and cabinet before he was elected. And like every other somewhat corrupt or very corrupt politician, he's just paying back the dues, the debt he owes.
Well, I think he could have been elected without Wall Street. Yes, Wall Street gave him a ton of money, and that helped him. But Wall Street collapsed, and that helped Obama. Because remember, McCain and Palin were actually neck and neck with Obama until Lehman Brothers went under and all of Wall Street went down. And then McCain said, let's suspend our campaigns and go to Washington and put our heads together in a room on this with other legislators and economists. And McCain showed up and basically fell asleep and didn't say anything. And Obama showed that he had the intelligence, to run the country in times of economic crisis. And that was a big thing that helped Obama get going. And also Obama, to the extent that he talked the progressive talk during the campaign, that helped him a lot, too. So I don't think he needed to compromise himself with Wall Street to get elected. And certainly after getting elected, he didn't need to pick advisors like Rahm Emanuel or Larry Summers or people like that. I mean, he could have picked whoever he wanted. He was in power then.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
I'm just calling to make the point that voting matters, elections matter, and individual campaign donations matter. And although we won't have the chance to try to reelect Russ Feingold in this coming I think he voted against the Patriot Act, didn't he?
He was the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act, a tremendously courageous and prescient vote on his part, and prescient speech, for that matter.
We will have the chance to donate to non-right-wing politicians who are running for office in a little less than a year, and we should all take advantage of that. And I was watching the Barbara Walters special on Fascinating People and saw the John Kerry comment on Edward Snowden that he might compromise people and people might be killed because of his leaks. Didn't they sign up for that when they got into the surveillance and spy business?
Well, I mean, the whole thing about Snowden, jeopardizing people's lives, I think, is a smokescreen. There's not one single person that they've been able to produce to say that, such and such a person is at risk or much less been killed or U.S. intelligence has been compromised. So I think the whole Snowden thing is a witch hunt now. They didn't like the message, but then sometimes they say, I've heard Obama say and some other people from the intelligence community say, this is a conversation we needed to have. Well, we wouldn't have been having the conversation if this guy didn't blow the whistle on you guys. So I don't think they should be hunting him down in the four corners of the earth. I do worry that he could get bumped off, Snowden, certainly. As far as campaign donations, people do what they want during campaigns as far as making donations. But the crucial point is we need to amend the Constitution to say that corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech. And until we amend the Constitution, the people who have the wherewithal to make the biggest campaign contributions are going to be able to swamp our democratic system.
I think it's fascinating that someone like John Kerry and where he sits at this point in time, Obama, Kerry, Hagel, they're killing people every day on a regular basis with the drone war in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, and so on. There was just this a bombing of another wedding, right? And that blowback, right, will come back to haunt us, the U.S. writ large, at some point or another, because when you wipe out whole families, whole clans, when you carry on that kind of, collateral damage, that's what jeopardizes us.
Right, and it's not just you and I who think that. Bob Baer, who was on the Bin Laden desk at the CIA, I just saw him on CNN. He was asked about the bombing of that wedding, the drone bombing. He said, we're creating more enemies than we're killing with every one of these things. And it's just counterproductive. But back to John Kerry, I mean, the ultimate irony there, John Kerry goes to Vietnam and criticizes Vietnam on their human rights record after what the United States did to Vietnam when Kerry was there.
Right. Not a word about the Saudis. Again, this is your hour. We're having a kind of general conversation here, various topics. Nigel says we have two people waiting on the line, so let's go continue on with the phones. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to clarify a comment I made a few minutes ago. I'll be really quick. I wasn't saying that Obama was justified in that he couldn't have been elected without Wall Street or that he's justified in anything he's doing now. I was just asking for your opinion on whether he made deals with you know, the military, with Wall Street, or with the NSA, or whoever else, maybe with the Bush administration, before he was elected, and that he is now corruptly fulfilling those promises.
Oh, I don't know if he made those deals, and I'm sorry if I misunderstood you the first time. But I think you're absolutely right that he is a compromised individual. And that came out most clearly in one of those early books on the Obama administration, where he's meeting with the bankers. He's brought the bankers to the White House, and he gets them in the room, and they're all scared that he's going to spank them, basically, and regulate them again, or dissolve the big ones or something. Or fire them like he did the head of GM. And he had the power to do that. But he said, he got them all gathered in the room and he said, you know what, I'm on your side. You guys just have a PR problem. Let me help you. And they basically left the room laughing. And they did laugh all the way back to the bank. And so he just has not used the power that he has had in a very progressive way when he had an opportunity to do so. In a sense, he's discredited progressivism without enacting progressivism, and it certainly was true with the way he handled those bankers. Whether he made private deals or not, he somehow was brought around to bowing to the banks.
I don't know if you listened to it or read it in the aftermath, but Obama's speech at the Mandela Memorial was really something. There was this whole passage about how we can't countenance regimes that hold political prisoners, dissidents, persecute dissidents, and so on. And immediately there was lots of response about the people that we hold here in this country who are political dissidents. Any thoughts, you know, or broader about that coverage, especially of the Mandela Memorial, and suddenly this guy became the hero of people who would have held him in prison forever but a few years back.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States was an enemy of the people of the majority of people in South Africa and Southern Africa for decades. I mean, the CIA fingered Mandela and helped the South African apartheid regime capture Mandela in the early 60s. And there was just so much kind of rewriting of history over the last few weeks, just before our very eyes. It was kind of horrifying to watch. On one level, you know, they tried to make Mandela into Gandhi or Martin Luther King, and he wasn't Gandhi or Martin Luther King. And this is a problem for me because I lean toward pacifism, but Mandela was for armed struggle. Mandela recognized in the early 60s that they'd tried a lot of nonviolent efforts to get at the apartheid regime, and it wasn't going to work, so that they had to take up arms. And that's something that pacifists have to struggle with, this question of national liberation struggles. And Mandela is the one who kind of crystallizes that, because he's such a positive figure, and yet he was one who was a proponent of armed struggle. And it's an open question how much the armed struggle led to the overthrow of apartheid. I know a lot of people just want to say it was the sanctions, and sanctions were important, or the labor struggles, and labor struggles were important. But you can't wish away the fact that there was also armed struggle going on.
Well, certainly the defeat of the South African army in Angola in that broader war in South Africa, with the assistance of
Cuba,
some 6,000 volunteers from Cuba, all the historians say that was the turning point in the bigger struggle for the liberation of Southern Africa.
There's also another part of the Mandela story that's kind of the flip side, and that is, you know, Mandela, as Naomi Klein points out in the Shock Doctrine, I mean, Mandela did not make good on his promise to nationalize the industries and to lift people out of poverty.
As a matter of fact, there's a tremendous column on exactly that topic by Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. People should go online and check that out. There was this democratic opening, but the power structures of corporate rule remained primarily in white hands, with an ascendant black African entrepreneurial class that took advantage of the moment. But the situation, the living conditions for the masses in South Africa are abhorrent still to this moment.
Yeah, I mean, Mandela, and the fact of the matter is, he bowed to international capital.
256-2001. Nigel says we have someone else coming in on the line. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering if the guests would agree that the prospective U.S. intervention in Syria that was in a sort of an unprecedented way thwarted by public opinion and forced into diplomatic channels in an apparently successful process of destruction of the chemical weapons, that's one of the most remarkable developments of 2013. However, we know that in these sorts of these instances, nothing is ever off the table. We'll recall that in 1998, Bill Clinton was feverish to intervene in Iraq, and that was thwarted temporarily until December of that year by public opinion. So what do you think is going to happen with regard to Syria? It's a festering wound on the world body politic.
Well, it's a good question, and I agree with the caller that the rediscovery of diplomacy in regards to Syria, but also in regards to Iran, was one of the biggest developments of 2013. Was it because of public opinion? That's an open question. I mean, certainly the American public was against it, and when Congress went back for the weekend to consult with the people of the United States, the people of the United States weren't for bombing Syria. But that hasn't stopped presidents in the past, and I've got to think that the foreign policy establishment and the military establishment here in the United States recognized that this was not a winning strategy to go knock off Assad or even to wound Assad's forces, because the forces on the other side were so volatile and many of them al-Qaeda dominated.
You know, of course, one of the things that's forgotten here was the thing began to turn when David Cameron was defeated in Parliament, right? That defeat, that if they couldn't get the UK in line, right? And that came from the peace movement and the popular movement, the resistance in the UK. That's true. With the UK not on board, that's when it began to shift. Now, of course, there's this other incredible shift now. There's this base overrun. You know, the U.S. was channeling these, quote, not non-lethal materiel to the Free Syrian Army, the so-called moderates overrun by these jihadis, this Islamist factions. And suddenly the U.S. says, well, we're no longer going to give non-lethal aid to the people we were supporting because we don't know what can happen with it. And now there's all this talk, if you read the international press at all, there's all this talk about coming around to a position of, well, we'd rather have Assad remain in power, or at least his factions remain in power, rather than give it up to the Islamists. That's an incredible pivot.
Yeah, it's a 180. For the longest time, Obama was saying, you know, Assad has got to go. It doesn't look like he feels like Assad has got to go at this point.
Let's shift gears here a little bit, Matt, and of course we can come back to whatever people want to discuss. State politics. That is, the past few days there's been this talk about what this education reform offensive, and with all connotations of that word taken into mind by the Walker administration, to basically restructure the whole method of granting charters, charter schools in state. An incredible thing. They've been talking about it for a long time.
Yeah, and I've got to salute Ruth Conniff, the great new editor of The Progressive, for all that she's been doing to draw attention to this attack on public education, not only here in Wisconsin, but around the country. And we've got a new website over at The Progressive that she has established called publicschoolshakedown.org. You can go there and see what's happening all over the country. But as far as here in Wisconsin, yeah, Walker's continuing his war on public education here. And just this week, Ruth Conniff posted something on our website at progressive.org about this education committee meeting at the state Senate on Wednesday, where they were trying to loosen the process for authorizing new charter schools in Milwaukee and then allowing these schools to replicate themselves automatically if they outperform average Milwaukee public schools on tests. I mean, this is just an effort at total dismantling of public education here in Wisconsin. And, I think people need to be aware of it and fight this at every school district in the state.
Yeah, it's not only, yes, it's totally the dismantling of public education. But they're bypassing the State Department of Public Instruction, which is a state of Wisconsin constitutionally chartered body.
Yeah,
right?
And on this one, they're doing it all for a California-based charter school company that I'd never heard of before called Rocket Ship.
Rocket Ship.
Its profits may rocket if it gets this deal. But.
Profit Ship. 256-2001. And then the thing in the state, right on the front page of the state journal this morning, they want to do away with income tax in the state.
Oh, yeah, and raise the most regressive tax there is, which is the sales tax.
Right, right. Yeah, let's do away with income tax, and we'll make it up by a sales tax. And it gets back, of course, to that whole business of drowning the government in the bathtub. The government is the problem. What are these people thinking?
Well, I mean, it's grab as much power as you can, dismantle as much government as you can, so your friends who pay for your campaigns can make as much profit as they can. And that's what's going on. I mean, Walker, the second he doesn't get elected to either governorship or, God forbid, presidency of the United States, is going to be able to cash out in a huge way from all these companies that he's been helping all along.
Yeah, I know this whole business of him running for president. Well, what was it? Alexis de Tocqueville in his Democracy in America touring the United States in the Age of Jackson in the 1830s. There's a wonderful little passage in that gigantic book about observing how campaigns were run in the 1830s already. De Tocqueville, who was, he was an aristocrat and he had a kind of contempt for democracy, but he was curious about it. And he talked about how, after watching one of those campaigns in 1832 or 1834, he said that the system as it exists will forever push forward mediocrity. Scary stuff.
Yeah, but I don't underestimate Scott Walker. I mean, I think there may be a 3 or 4 or 5% chance he becomes president. He's a darling of the right wing, of the corporate right wing. He'll have plenty of money. It depends how well he does running for governor. And he said this week that it sure looks like he's going to run for governor. And it's ridiculous for those people who think he's not going to run for governor again. Look, I mean, he's not the smartest guy in the world, but he is very disciplined. And he's always on point and on message. And he does that all shucks kind of soft-spoken Boy Scout demeanor in small groups. And the mayor of Milwaukee wasn't able to beat him twice, so he can't be totally discounted, and so I just think it's something to watch for.
Hello, caller, you're on the air.
See, I just wanted to add a little bit about Angola. You mentioned Angola earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And the white South African forces did try to intervene there and kind of thwart the guerrilla movements that were there. And they were pretty effective until the Cubans intervened. And then the Cubans had some modern equipment, radar and anti-aircraft weapons. And they were able to turn the tables on the white South Africans. And they found that very disheartening. And in my estimation, that led to serious negotiations, and basically the realization that apartheid could not sustain itself, and so they had to compromise.
Yeah, as I said earlier, that was the turning point in that whole campaign, that the South African army intervening in the civil war in Angola, and then the Cubans coming in on the side of the liberation struggle, and it definitely, all the historians, the people that have written about it, say it was a turning point.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, I believe the first head of state that Mandela met after he became president was Fidel Castro.
Yeah, he goes, interestingly, his first visits outside of the country, he goes first to Cuba to thank the Cubans, not just to buddy up or shake hands with Fidel.
Have a cigar with Fidel.
Yeah, yeah. But to thank the Cubans for the sacrifices they made. The Cubans, of course, understanding what was at stake. But it also, You know, there was this solidarity that the Cubans have long understood, the solidarity with Africa. Interestingly, the second place that he visited was Gaddafi's Libya. And he went to, and he visited with Gaddafi. You know, that history is truly remarkable. And again, it gets back to this whole thing, this kind of sanitizing of Mandela now, in much the same way that Martin Luther King was sanitized by many. They want to put him up on the on some kind of pedestal now. And the guy, you know, he was a tactician, a politician, a revolutionary. All this business. You know, his close association always, and there's some discussion about it now. But his close association always with the South African Communist Party, with mm-hmm. Joe Slovo and Ruth First, and the people in that movement. You know, very, very important.
And his first speech out of prison, remember when he came out there and he was with Winnie Mandel and he has his fist raised. But remember, the speech he gave that day wasn't a speech filled with poetry and high-flying rhetoric. It was thanking all the people and all the organizations. Many of them were communist-inspired or certainly communist-led or peopled by a lot of people in the Communist Party. I mean, so he just ran it down, one organization after another. He was thanking his comrades. That's what he was doing.
Right. What? Mandela was a communist? Go on. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, I figured out a way to shut up the people that run the Cubans down and run Castro down. And they haven't any way to run Mandela down. So I ask them, how come when the Cubans leadership goes out in the world and meets Mandela, they share hugs. And that usually shuts them up. And, of course, the reasons are what you've already given on the program, that the Cubans are about the only people in the world that ever actually did anything to put an end to apartheid. So thanks for the program, and thanks for the info.
Appreciate the call, too. I mean, it's sad to me, though, the controversy that came about when Obama shook the hand of Raul Castro, because this was just protocol. You know, he was in line with all the other heads of state, and he just went down the line and shook hands with everybody. And yet the right wing and the Republicans just went crazy about it, as though he was shaking hands with the devil. When, in actual fact, I mean, it was, you know, Raul Castro had better standing there than any president of the United States did. And yet we still can't get over this 50-year and more boycott of Cuba that's done nothing to overthrow the Cuban government but just to make life miserable for a lot of Cubans.
You know, and of course, and if you start running down the list of dictators of the right, murderers, gangsters, mafiosos of all sorts in state power over the through the course of the Cold War, the past 50, 60 years, it becomes utterly absurd.
Yeah, that, and you can compare them to dictators in Latin America, or Suharto in Indonesia, who killed 500,000 people to 1 million people with help from the CIA in 1965, and then 200,000 people in East Timor in 1975. And, you know, make a comparison with Castro. There's no comparison.
Let's go back to the Middle East a bit, Matt. That is the business around, we touched on it in passing, but this opening of diplomacy toward Iran. Of course, it sends some people on the right into a tizzy.
Sends some Israeli rightists and Saudis into a tizzy, too.
Right.
It's very interesting to me. I mean, I've long thought that, especially after reading Uri Avneri, the great Israeli peace activist who used to be a member of the Knesset, and he's been saying forever that the idea that the United States or Israel was going to bomb Iran was just totally irrational, because it would have brought down the world economy, because the Iranians would have retaliated and cut off the oil flow from the Persian Gulf, and also there would have been attacks on Israel, and it just didn't make any sense. And plus, it would slow down only by a year any attempt by Iran to build a nuclear weapon. So it's just that the United States and Israel, the rightists in both countries, were making points just by, banging their chests and trying to be macho about Iran. And finally here, I think Obama made good on one promise, and that was to talk to anybody, including Iran, when he was asked by Hillary Clinton, who was just aghast at the possibility during the campaign, the first campaign, that Obama, if he were to become president, would talk to the Iranians. But here we have Obama talking to the Iranians, not person to person yet, but I think that may yet come.
Yeah, Hillary, she frightens me.
Right. Well, there she was last night on Barbara Walters, sounding for all the world like a candidate. So I think people who think she's not going to run are kidding themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's people scrambling already that she's a darling for some, and she's her foreign policy stuff. You know, there was recently this business. Suddenly, the United States needs the dictatorship in Uzbekistan to help funnel materiel into Afghanistan after Pakistan closed its border in late 2011. And John Kerry, at the time, is head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Hillary Clinton goes before the Senate committee. The Senate had cut off arms shipments and supplies of materiel to the Karimov dictatorship. Why? Because of its abuse of human rights. Documented, I mean, the Karimov regime boils people alive, right? And aid to that regime was cut off since 2004. Hillary Clinton goes, and they, in claiming national security requests for, they got a waiver to start shipping, aiding this Karimov regime. Why? Because they needed that northern alliance, that northern distribution network to provide materiel to Afghanistan. So that kind of, what is that? That's diplomacy. That's being diplomatic. It was this kind of vile stuff.
I mean, her foreign policy has always been hawkish. She's been terribly hawkish on Cuba forever. When she was Secretary of State, she was really hawkish on Syria and on Libya, which was a grotesque violation of the Constitution and the War Powers Act by President Obama. And Dennis Kucinich said he should be impeached for that. And then, remember, Hillary Clinton was on the board of directors of Walmart, which is not really in keeping with the times here, as we've had this great rebellion in 2013 here against by low-wage workers, fast-food workers and low-wage service workers. So I don't know how she's going to appeal to some segments of the base in the Democratic Party, and yet she is great. She has been great on the issue of women's rights. That's undeniable. And she is a pathbreaker, and that's undeniable, too. And she's really smart, and she works hard. So I don't sell her short. I just think people should be aware of what her actual policies are.
You know, Hillary Clinton on the board of, Walmart?
Walmart, yeah.
It reminds me of Chuck Hagel having to give up his seat as on the board of directors of Chevron in order to go to the Defense Department.
Well, it's right out of C. Wright Mills, isn't it?
Yeah. And, of course, we just got 10 minutes left in the hour, but people are suddenly calling in, so I'm going to ask people to keep it short. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
I am really tired of media and others making into male leaders in various countries, presidents or whatever, making them into some kind of saints. I'm sorry. Think of John F. Kennedy. Think of Martin. Think of Nelson Mandela in particular, whose wife Winnie backed him up for years and years and years, went to visit him, and on and on. And when he gets out, he discards her.
Well, I don't. It's Matt Rothschild talking, and Alan can all speak for himself. Lord knows. But first of all, I haven't been making anybody out into a saint, including President Obama, whose faults I've been pointing out. But, Winnie Mandela herself wasn't a saint. And I think we need to be clear on that. I mean, she was allegedly involved in running a so-called soccer club that allegedly was involved in murdering a couple people.
But also, it's interesting that she's also leveled political criticisms about the course and direction that the ANC has gone in. So it's complex there. We got three more people that want to get in before the end of the hour. So please, everyone, keep it short, and we'll try to get you in. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was reading recently the new woman that was elected president of Chile, and her name escapes me right
Bachelet.
Now, but I guess, all I could think of was, gosh, somewhere down the line, I hope that nothing happens to her or the country that did to President Allende, since she's a socialist. You feel that anything like this could happen, the CIA could get in there and, you know, mess things up again.
Well, she was elected before and served before and was, you know, not a victim of assassination, so I doubt that it would happen again. I mean, there's no guarantee anywhere. But she was a pretty good president last time around and did a lot for women's rights and for health care in Chile. She also, I visited Santiago when she was in power, and she had established in Santiago a museum of memory and human rights. It's an incredible thing. If you're ever, any of you listening, ever in Santiago, you should go. This is it talks about what happened during the coup, and actually you go into the main room and then there's a film of the palace being bombed, and then there's a tape of Pinochet surrounded by two other generals giving a speech to the nation. You can hear it in English translation as I did, and this is what fascism sounds like, because they talk about God and country, and that's why they took over. And private property.
And, of course, there is a very different correlation of forces in South America now. The United States is not calling the shots literally and figuratively like they once did. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello, Alan.
Please.
Yes. Well, just a quick response to the last caller. You don't even have to go to Santiago to see the film. It's called The Battle of Chile, and it's definitely worth seeing. And I was going to say an interesting anecdote about the Castro brothers. Actually, Clinton was the first president to shake hands with one of them, but he tried to evade Fidel, but Fidel won that match and managed to get a handshake with him. My main comment was on Cuba. What I find outrageous, regardless of what you think of the Castro government, I find it outrageous that a small, tiny minority of individuals in South Florida have been able for 50 years to make foreign policy with respect to Cuba for an entire country. I mean, I think that's outrageous, and that is something that needs to be discussed more thoroughly. And thanks for taking the call.
Very quickly on that, I would just assert that it's no longer monolithic amongst those Cubans in Miami. There's a whole younger generation that wants an opening and so on. Unfortunately, that old guard, those old Bay of Pigs Cubans are no longer what they once were. So there's some optimism there. Folks watching that situation clearly are saying it's in flux, it's in transition. Let's go back to the phones. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I wonder if you would comment on why has 60 Minutes become so outrageously pro-military in the past months, so that three times in a row they've obviously distorted the news. What's going on at a major program like 60 Minutes?
Well, I can't give a great answer on that. I know they did this very distorted article presentation, a piece on the NSA on Sunday, and it was one of the people working on it had been in the NSA or high up in the NSA. So, you know, they don't rock the boat the way they used to rock the boat, that's for sure.
I mean, it's certainly an indicator of what, Bob McChesney and Nichols and lots of other media critics have talked about that there's that corporate complex, media complex, that is very much a part, wedded to and very much a part of the power relations in this country. I would find it quite astounding if they really did critical journalism.
Yeah, I mean, ask yourself why Edward Snowden didn't go to 60 Minutes. I mean, he did try to go to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they wouldn't take it, so he went... he went to Glenn Greenwald and went to The Guardian. But, 60 Minutes is no longer the place for really journalism that takes on the powers that be.
Yeah, and, back in its heyday, it's Mike Wallace heyday, there was certainly some important critical stuff, at least on domestic, issues that went on. I think, might be a reflection. I'm not sure. I wouldn't bank on it. But a reflection of the passing, again, of that generation. But again, it's who owns CBS? What do they belong to? What are they part of? It's that, again, that military, industrial, corporate media complex. I wouldn't expect anything different, actually.
Hmm.
You know, my friend from the UK, Tariq Ali, he was here back a couple of years ago, and I said, you know, the media coverage is so bad in the States that I listen to and watch the BBC, and he said, my good man, nobody watches it in the UK. It's all relative in that sense. Matt, what else? We got like 3 minutes. What else? You still got your list there. What haven't we touched on?
Well, it's just, you know, big picture, what's going on in Wisconsin is going on around the country and around the world. It is the one of the fundamental issues other than global warming and nuclear weapons, and that is the issue that Fighting Bob LaFalle talked about all the time. It's democracy versus plutocracy. We're seeing it here with the GTAC mine, and the mining company writes the bill, and Walker does his little service to the mining company and signs the bill. It was like the Walker with the Koch brothers phone call. I mean, he's there in service of the corporations. And so the question really is, you know, who's going to rule in this country and around the world? Is it going to be the people, or is it going to be the people with the money, the tiny few at the top? And that's what's going on. So, you know, I'm heartened to see the revolt of the low-wage workers. And I still am heartened by the revolt here in Wisconsin, the great uprising that we had in the last couple of years by the people at those Solidarity sing-alongs, by the people up at in Iron County at the mines, by the Native Americans who are being very active in opposition to the GTAC mine. So here in Wisconsin, we have, you know, Walker's war on women, public education, voting rights, the environment, and then we just have, you know, Wall Street and ExxonMobil and IMF, and you know, this is the crisis.
You know, if you were to Google opposition to gold mining or opposition to mining, you'll find that there's this global phenomenon going on right now, and there's a massive campaign against this major Canadian-owned gold mine in Kyrgyzstan. There's this opposition to this fracking and mining in Romania and so on and so forth. So it's going on. I got to wrap up here. Nigel's giving me the signal it's time to leave, folks. So, of course, I want to thank Nigel. I want to thank Megan, who's sitting here in the studio with us on the laptop. Our guest today, of course, Matt Rothschild, Carol out on the phones. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week.
Better watch out, you better not Skype, you better log out, yeah, you better not type. The NSA is coming to town. You're making a list, they're checking it twice, they're watching almost every electronic device. The NSA is coming to town.